How do the best data scientists in the world master their data sets, train their models, and climb the data science ladder? Let's ask them. My name's Jeremy, and this is the Towards Data Science podcast.
Institution you're coming from, you can get access to the very latest research.
We also have to make sure that we're constantly revisiting our foundations and justifying why we're using the methods we are.
At that time, I said, and I want people to hear this, that you have worth and you have skills, and there's someone who needs that somewhere.
And boom, new year, new you, new me, new podcast episode. Welcome everyone to the Towards Data Science podcast for our first episode of 2020. As always, my name is Jeremy and I'm on the team over at the Sharpest Minds Data Science Mentorship Program. And before we kick things off, I want to frame this episode a little bit because I think so much of what you'll hear us talk about has to do with a trend that I don't think nearly enough data scientists today are paying attention to. And that trend is the increasing value of product focus and storytelling in data science and analytics. So if the 2010s were the decade that machine learning and analytics really found their place in industry, then the 2020s are really going to be the decade where they become tools that everyone can use. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone, not just data analysts, not just data scientists, not just people who specialize in building dashboards all day, but also people like software engineers, like product people, even business people. Everyone's going to be able to use data in new and interesting ways, and as a result, as more and more of these tools make it easier and easier for laypeople to build and use predictive models, manipulate data, and so on, data scientists are really going to have to evolve. They're going to have to get good at new things. And those things include things like storytelling and getting good at product. And that's why I'm so excited to be sitting down today with Nate Nichols, who's the VP of Product Architecture at Narrative Science, which is a company that specializes in data storytelling. Nate has some really interesting background. I mean, he's done a PhD in CS, where he specialized in sort of NLP-related tasks about a decade ago or more now. So he's got a lot of great NLP experience. He brings that to bear at Narrative Science, but now his focus is more on the product side. And so he's got some great advice for aspiring data scientists and data analysts about really some of the most mission-critical skills you'll need to grow and move your career forward in the years ahead. So Nate, thanks so much for joining us for the podcast.
Great. Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, Jeremy.
You've got a really interesting background in that you've pulled off what I think today would be considered a somewhat abrupt transition. You went from a PhD in CS into a software-focused and then later actually a product-focused role at Narrative Science, which is a company you've been at for like a better part of a decade, right?
Almost. It'll be 10 years this summer. It's almost 10.
Wow. Okay. That's really cool in and of itself. So that transition, though, especially the product-focused role, that's something I definitely want to get into, and I think it's something that a lot of data scientists need to hear more about, that plus the storytelling aspect of narrative science. Just to get things started, could you speak a little bit to your academic background? Like, how did you get into data science, and how did your PhD play into your data science career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I came out of undergrad. I did my undergrad in computer science at DePaul University, a liberal arts school in Indiana. And I knew coming out of that I wanted to keep learning and to sort of to get the kinds of careers that I couldn't get just coming straight out of school with a BA in computer science. So I applied to a few places and ended up going to Northwestern. Started in a learning science program there that was doing a bunch of cool stuff, but was pretty heavily in the learning science space. So I switched my first year to one of the artificial intelligence groups called the Intelligent Information Laboratory. And what the group was really focused on was taking all the information that's available in the world and making that present and available to someone right when they need it. Mm-hmm. And so for my particular part of that, what I was doing was working on knowing something about the user and then actually building a little news show for them. It was called News at 7. It originally started on the Half-Life 2 engine. If you've played Half-Life 2, our original version of the system had Alex Vance actually talking to you, hacking around in the Half-Life 2 engine before we ended up moving to Flash. But the real research component there was if we know something about somebody, we know what teams they're interested in, what movies they like, what types of news they follow, maybe what their politics are, how does a system then go out to the internet and find really interesting things and bring that back to them and present it in a way that's is interesting? It's not just a list of links, but in our case, it was actually pulling together a cohesive news show. So it was a 3 or 4 minute long show talking about teams you care about, talking about movies you're interested in, and in particular is recontextualizing a lot of what it was saying. So it wasn't just sort of reading snippets from articles. It was finding different viewpoints and combining them into a single document. It was pulling out B-roll from YouTube and having a person talk over that as they talked about developments in another country. We'd have B-roll sort of that country in the background, trying to make it really feel like a news show. And for me, it was really exciting because the whole time the system was being built, it was always visible. It was always, you could see what it was doing. You could actually sort of understand what it was doing. There are places where it would miss things. You know, we were doing sentiment analysis, trying to find positive and negative tweets, and that doesn't work well in a lot of tweet circumstances. So we had to do some things to try and find sarcasm, for example, and pull out the sarcastic tweets. Classic NLP problem there, finding sarcasm.
Very hard one too.
But yeah. Especially if you've only got, 140 or 280 characters to do that in. But so there are all these little problems that came up along the way. But again, it was really exciting for me because the end result was something immediately compelling. We were in talks with MTV about putting it on their website for a while. We've launched in a couple different places. It was a thing that people could see that felt really intelligent when you saw it, and that it resonated with people, and they sort of got the appeal of it. And for me, that was super satisfying, being in grad school and seeing so many people work in super technical fields where they're doing, they're doing really deep machine learning models, or they're doing database optimizations, or they're doing, theoretical network configurations that can drive, higher than ever throughput. And that's super great work to be doing. I'm really glad people smarter than me are working on those problems. But for me, I've always been really interested in things that sort of make sense to everybody, and things you can actually communicate to a normal person, someone who's not super quantitative like me or you, Jeremy, or our listeners. So for me, it was great. It was a great experience.
There's so much to unpack there, not least of which is the era that this is all happening in, right? Because this is really back in before the days of deep learning. This is before 2012. There's no AlexNet. There's no Glove. There's no Word2Vec. So this is all hacked together TF-IDF stuff, really, that you're doing, right?
Yeah. It was super simple. And it was very hacked together. And I remember, I mentioned Flash earlier, the whole thing ran on top of Flash because that was sort of the way to do audio visual stuff on the fly back then. In it was 2005 to 2010 was when I was in grad school at Northwestern. And I remember when the iPhone came out in 2009, I think 2010, whenever that was, it was like, we've got to figure out how to make this run on the iPhone now. And it was we were the only people rooting for Flash to run on the iPhone because the News at 7 would just work there. It's like, oh, we've got to do all this again. Cause it came out and it was so immediately obvious. Oh, this is how people will consume this when they're on the go. It's going to be on an iPhone or Android or whatever. But yeah, it was early days, and it was before Facebook had sort of gotten into and everybody else had followed that really hyper-personalization train. And I think, which was kind of nice because we avoided all the issues now of, creating bubbles and only showing people what they want to see.
Yeah.
And these sort of like meme holes you can go down. There was never, our system was never promoting anti-Semitic content or sort of any of the things that come up now. But yeah, it was very hacked together. And that, I started out being ashamed or strong, but a little bit embarrassed about how it works sometimes, especially, again, you're with a bunch of other smart grad students and everybody's really smart and they're, they've got this really technical problem that they've solved. And when I hear about it, my head just spins about how you can get a database to work that quickly, for example. And they would ask me what I was working on and I would show like, here's the Python file and it goes out. This is the part where it hits Google. This is where it's scraping Google. This is where it's going to YouTube. And it turns out if you just filter out videos less than a minute, you get rid of a lot of junk. It's nothing smart. It's not doing anything clever, but there's a bunch of those kind of tips and tricks. But it worked again. And for me, that's the important thing. It makes it hard to get a PhD out of it, frankly, because you're sort of earning that thesis or earning that doctorate on what the system is sort of doing under the covers.
Yeah.
But I got through it and got my doctorate. And now I think it's exactly the right mindset for actually being out in industry and thinking about things from user's perspective. And they don't care how technically impressive it is. They don't care that you use the new framework you're interested in. They care about, you know, the value it's providing to them. So it was kind of a hard mindset in grad school occasionally, but I think it's served me really well now.
It must be the only PhD program that would be product focused that I can imagine. And paradoxically, I mean, you know, this is something I talk to a lot of aspiring data scientists in my day-to-day. And one of the things that keeps coming up over and over is exactly what you talked about. There's this almost trend towards over-specialization and getting super deep into, you know, optimizing for tooling, optimizing for, for algorithms rather than for use cases. So I'm guessing this really helped then as you're transitioning to the workforce. You already have this kind of product mindset. Did that help you when you were interviewing?
Yeah, I think so. And it was also... speaking about it being one of the few PhD programs with a product focus, that's really credit to my advisor, Chris Hammond at Northwestern and co-director of the lab, Larry Birnbaum. And they set that up from the beginning. That wasn't me. I think my personality aligned with it well, but there had been a few other products that had gotten spun out of the info lab before I'd even gotten there. So they really had a track record of producing things. And that was how I actually got this job, because when I was finishing up grad school, my plan was to be a professor at the journalism school, in particular at Northwestern Medill. They were, you know, as I mentioned, my research work was sort of news adjacent, and I spent some time there. I took a class on how to do a production, like a broadcast news show. And I'd spoken a lot with the professors there, and this was 2010, and they were intentionally trying to hire new professors that had a strong computer science background. Either they were developers or they had, you know, PhD like me. And that was the job I was going for because I really liked teaching. I really liked communication, storytelling, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And so I spent a long time trying to get that job. But in the meantime, there was another group of undergrads and master's students working on this technology called StatsMonkey, which eventually became Narrative Science's core technology. And they were working on that with Chris and Larry, my advisors. And the CEO of Narrative Science, Stuart Frankel, we describe him as hanging around the university at the time. He'd retired. He'd made a bunch of money being successful. His company got acquired by Google. I think he'd retired, and then he got bored, and so he was trying to find something cool to work on and lead. And so we were kind of trying out different ideas in the lab, different things coming out. And there was a few different. One of the other ones was it would watch the closed captioning stream and try to find products and news that were relevant to the show you're watching right then and surface it. But the one that really stuck was a StatsMonkey, which was trying to generate baseball stories from box office data. So if we know, you know, who got the hits, when the strikeouts were, you can tell I'm not a big sports guy. my sports language gets pretty loose. But so the system would write a story, a summary of the baseball game based off that. And I mean this as a compliment to the students or the people who built it who ended up being employees here. It was the hackiest thing ever, right? It was a bunch of Python that you would run it. It would break sometimes. And when it didn't break, story. You'd see this output, and it would talk about, you know, it was a come from behind victory and things look grim for the Tigers until the Cubs came swinging back in the sixth inning. And it was really good. And it was really, the output was really good. And when you open up the actual code, it's like, oh man, there's kind of, you just see all the logic. It's just raw Python. You know, there wasn't much encapsulation or representation. It was just a bunch of Python that would produce this miraculous story. And so again, thinking of, you know, really leading with the product and leading with the experience, that was what we showed was a story. And people didn't believe that a computer could write that, you know, and knowing how it worked, we're like, it's really clear how it could write that. Here's a bunch of if conditions that are testing whether it was a come from behind victory. Here's a bunch of string templates. When you put the variables in the right spot, we have to be a little careful about whether it's an S or an ES at the end of this word, like just little sort of, you know, spit and baling wire kind of thing to hold it together. But it totally worked. And so as I was finishing my PhD in May of 2010, I kept waiting to get this Medill offer, and I'd spent a ton of time there. I taught a class there. I did job talks. I met with all the faculty, and this offer kept not coming in. And then in the meantime, I started working at Narrative Science during the summer. And the idea was, I'll be here for a couple months. Then my real job will start. My real life will start. When you're in academia, you often get 20% time to yourself as sort of consulting things on the side. It's like, okay, cool. I'll spend that 20% time in narrative science, but my real job will be this faculty position. But I came in and started trying to break down StatsMonkey and why it worked, and pulled out the bits that were reusable. This is where, we call them angles, but this is where we're testing conditions against the data. This is where we're choosing between one of three equivalent ways of saying something, but we have a few different ways for variability. This is where we need to conjugate verbs properly, like starting to pull out those consistencies, because early on, we knew the company wasn't going to be a baseball stories company, right? We love writing baseball stories. We write a ton of them for Game Changer. We write, I think, hundreds of thousands of Little League game recaps every year. It's great. People love them. They're super fun and good, but that was never going to be a business model for the company. And so I started in trying to kind of pull out the more generalized things and actually turning this into an engine that can write stories, and you can configure it in a bunch of different ways, but there's sort of predefined places where you can slot in. And that, again, that was also held together by duct tape, but I got a demo of that working in the first like 10 days I was here. It's just like, kind of just threw myself at it, and got a lot up and running. And that was enough to get the CEO we started talking about what if I stayed here and didn't go back to Northwestern. And then the job offer finally came through from Northwestern. But by that point I was pretty far gone. And it was like, this is narrative science is happening, and I can either come in now and be the seventh employee on this rocket ship, and that seems like it's going to be a ton of fun to be on, or I can be sitting on the sidelines, like watching it go. And it was like, I couldn't bear that feeling. That sort of like that FOMO was so crystallized in that moment. It's like, I can't do this. I may go back to being a professor in the future.
Yeah.
Northwestern will still be there. Medill's a great school. It'll be there. But this was an opportunity that felt like it was kind of leaving the station, and I really wanted to be on it.
Well, and I think it'll be worth diving into the startup aspect, how it is to be a data scientist, especially like employee number seven at a startup. But I think there are a couple of points that you raise that are so rich. But there are a number of things I think that are worth highlighting for folks who are maybe listening as aspiring data scientists and trying to think their way through it, like how to think about product as a data scientist. I mean, you mentioned so many interesting things, including tight focus on one vertical. You guys were focused on baseball, even though that had, that wasn't the big picture. That's where you started.
Yep.
And then building a very minimum viable product right out the gate that isn't, doesn't have all these bells and whistles, that's really user focused, something that meets a user's need without having complex neural networks in the back end. Can you speak to like how you guys iterated? Like, how did you know that this product was good enough without needing those bells and whistles? Did you put it in front of users, or how often did you do that?
That's a great question. We did. It's shifted a bit in the last 18 months as we're bringing on a new product, Lexio. It's sort of just come out in the last half of this past year, and it's the first time we've really been able to engage with actual users of our software. The people that are reading the stories can now, we can talk about this more, but they can actually read the stories in Lexio, and we're starting to get all the metrics that you want to get of how many stories are they reading, what do they click on the most, how often do they come back, all of that kind of good stuff. But for a long time, we had to, we would write, like I mentioned, we write hundreds of thousands of Little League game recaps. We don't talk to anybody that reads those formally. We have, we write it with a partner of ours called Game Changer. They know what their customers, what their readers are looking for, what they're most interested in. They work with us to sort of make sure the system is highlighting those. And then it goes out and the system, kind of does what, writes those stories, but we haven't had a lot of like concrete feedback from the actual readers. It's been more working with our customers who are sort of, can be an intermediary. But for us, the way we knew the content was good enough was pretty, it was pretty just looking at the stories. I mean, one of the things that's nice about what we do is we can mock things up pretty quickly. We know what our systems can do now. And because the final output is either text or text with some interactions and charts, a few charts on top of it, it's pretty easy for us to say, what if the software, what if the stories look like this? And we can go out and talk to people about, would you pay for this? What else is this missing? What things should be in the story that aren't here? What things are in the story that you don't care about? And we're starting, and we can get pretty concrete with users that way is one way we can hear from people. And that's, this is probably a little far afield for right now, but one of the things we're really excited about with Lexio is we can start to instead of us going to users and giving them a piece of paper or a screenshot and saying, if this were your story, how useful would this be? We can actually get that feedback directly from the app. And so we know what parts of the users or what parts of the story users are clicking on the most. We give them little feedback tools to say, this was helpful, this wasn't helpful. And so now we're starting to get into a place where the system can actually improve itself and can write the kinds of stuff that users are responding to, more of that kind of information and less of the other kind of information that people isn't resonating with people.
I find this especially interesting, just given that, like, so in my view, and this might be a controversial point, I think increasingly it's not, but I think I've been seeing data science move more and more in a bifurcated direction where you've got some data scientists who are becoming product people, others who are becoming engineers, and others who are becoming business people. And you've kind of got this, like, you know, there's one job title, but really, you know, you're going to be spending most of your time thinking about ways to build new product or whatever else. So in your case, I guess my first question is this something you see happening? And then I want to use this as an excuse to dive a little bit into, say, the things you look for if you're hiring in data science applicants as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The bifurcation or trifurcation you mentioned there. I was speaking with a friend of mine who is now applying and just got into some really great data science PhD programs. And a piece of feedback I gave him that I think is pretty generally applicable is he had a cover letter and statement of intent, that kind of stuff. And he was mentioning some of the new frameworks he'd used and how he'd built out, you know, it was a paper that came out in August and he was already like leveraging some of those algorithms in this piece of thing he was doing. And he was, you know, he's a super smart guy. It's super impressive that he was able to do that. That's awesome. And the feedback I gave him was, if this were on your resume, I would want to know what was so special about the problem you were trying to solve that only a model or approach that was 4 months old could tackle that. Like,
yeah,
are you sure you needed that? There's probably an open source, some framework from 5 years ago that has a command line option that does something kind of close to that and gives you results that are mostly as good. And that's, you probably should use that. Like if you're doing personal projects, use the bleeding edge stuff. Like that's awesome. If you're trying to learn, like all those kinds of those projects are great for actually, you know, implementing a new algorithm from a paper, like that kind of stuff is great experience. But when I actually think about someone being in their role in a day to day, I want them to use pretty standard tools that we know how to support, that other people on the team know how to use, that there's documentation for, that the company doesn't go away, all of that kind of stuff. And I think, at least for the business and product side, but even for the, you know, sort of more engineering-minded data scientists, I think there's an idea that when you're a data scientist, you're a numbers person, and the numbers speak for themselves, right? And your job is to produce some model that produces numbers, or to produce some numbers, or to produce some, you know, some piece of visualization or something. And that's kind of where your job ends, and you've done your part, and now let the business people take it over or kind of hand it off. And it's just that isn't how people communicate. That isn't how ideas get spread. You don't sort of win by being right, right? You win by bringing everybody along with you. And so what I look for when we're looking at data scientists or people with more sort of quantitative backgrounds, it's those soft skills or the differentiator. There's a lot of people that know the frameworks that have run projects end to end, that know how to sort of manage the life cycle of models and do all of that. But there's a lot fewer people that can explain that in a way that makes sense, that can get people excited about that, that can get executives the right intuitions they need to have about this. They don't need all the details, but they need some of them and can sort of balance that.
Yeah,
that those soft skills are really the differentiator that I see and I look for.
Your F1 score can make a very compelling case, but if you can't convey it to management, you're not going very far.
Yeah, and I think for me, like I was sort of a math person growing up, and I remember being frustrated by that people wouldn't. It's like you have the right answer; it's so clearly the right answer, and you know, it's easy, especially when you're a moody teenager, to be like, everybody's dumb. Like, why are we talking about this? I have the right answer. But now you look at, you know, global warming. There's a right answer for climate change, but it's clearly not enough. It is not resonating with people. And you can be grumpy about that and say people are dumb, or you can say, well, we're actually trying to solve a problem here. So what's the message that people need to hear to get everybody on board with solving this problem? And I think trying to understand that whether or not people like should get it is is pretty irrelevant. It's whether or not they do get it. And it's your job as a data scientist to help people get it. And you have to like take that seriously.
I think there's something really profound in that, that there's a deeply human aspect to working in any environment, including to just being in a society where you kind of have to just accept that humans are not APIs and that information needs to be conveyed in a very specific way for it to land. I'm thinking here specifically about, like, so my brother and I have a startup, and we got into data science after doing grad school in physics, where we developed what we since came to refer to as cocky physicist syndrome, where essentially you work on something so fundamental. So you're telling yourself all day, you know, I know the equations that govern the universe. So there's nothing left for anybody else to tell me. And so you get into arguments with people, you're like, oh my God, just what you said. I mean, you dismiss people because they're stupid, rather than realizing like, A, people need things to be conveyed in a certain way. And B, the act of trying to convey that information sometimes reveals errors in your own thought process.
And yeah, absolutely.
This might be a good segue into the whole storytelling aspect of narrative science, because I think this is kind of the core of what you guys are working on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so data storytelling is where we're really sort of hanging our hat. And this is the idea that, like we've just been talking about, that a bar chart is not a story, a fact is not a story, an insight of a dashboard that pops up and says, you know, macaroni cheese sales spiked in Minneapolis last weekend by 14%. It's a statistical outlier. Like it may or may not be useful or relevant to somebody, but it's inert, right? It's just sort of there. And stories really move in a way that a chart or a fact doesn't. And so the idea with, data storytelling is that there's a really long journey between data numbers in a database and better outcomes for the business. And that's the reason we're, this is, you and all your listeners know, Jeremy, there's more and more data being collected every day. There's more and more analysis being done on top of it, but no one's doing that just for data's sake. They're trying to drive to some better outcome. Right. And so they want that data. They want have that data available in a way that people can understand it. People understand the world better as reflected by the data. People make better decisions. Better decisions lead to better outcomes. And typically what we've done historically is say, okay, well, we start with computers, and things computers are good at include drawing lines and shapes, doing math, persisting data, right? And so we say, okay, cool. That's the thing computers are good at. So let's use those things. And on top of the computer, we'll build Excel, we'll build traditional BI platforms, we'll build Tableau and Power BI and these things that are really good at letting people build different charts and viz, and for really quantitative types, like a lot of people listening today, they're comfortable in that space. They can play in that space. And then what we're doing is we're asking everybody who's actually trying to make those better decisions to cover 80% of the ground and to come all the way to the computer. And all the computer's doing is showing charts and graphs, and people have to do all of that work. And again, we can say people should be able to do all that work. It's just a line chart with 10 lines and a bar chart behind it. This is child's play. I learned this in third grade. People should be able to understand this. You can rant and rave about that, or you can say, look, in reality, people, they don't open dashboards.
Yeah.
They don't know how to interpret this data. They especially don't know how to look at a graph, understand that while it's going up and to the right, this is actually an overall period of slump, or it's going up and to the right at the expense of other products, or revenue is going up and to the right, but profit is not. There's all this sort of like business context that we're letting the computer off the hook for and saying people have to do all of that work. And so what we want to do in narrative science is move the needle closer to people so people don't have to go as far. And the basic thesis of the company is that instead of presenting the information in a way that computers present best, which is charts and graphs and spreadsheets, let's present it in a way that people learn and communicate best, and that's storytelling and language. And so this is a thing that we really believe in the company, to the point that I, a person in marketing and myself, wrote a book called Let Your People Be People. That's it's a free book if you come to narrativescience.com. But you can see how we think about storytelling broadly. It's not a sales pitch. It's actually sort of our thesis for how storytelling helps empower everyone in an organization and is good for the people and good for the organization. I also run a storytelling workshop here at the company. We bring people through and make everyone stand up and say things and be really mortified. And then they get feedback and then they go again and they get better and better. And we have this graduation show at the end that's really satisfying. So storytelling is really spread throughout the company. And we do that in a lot of different ways on the marketing side and throughout. But for us, that's, we do storytelling because we think that's how people learn. And instead of being cranky about that, we say, no, this is, let's embrace that. And frankly, this is a good time in human history to be embracing, like, let's do the thing for people that people are good at. Let's come to people, let's support people, let's enable people, empower people. And so that's where the drive for storytelling comes from.
It really resonates with me. The company that I founded that I work on now is actually kind of very aligned with this. It's a mentorship platform. For folks who want to get into data science. And the idea is you build a project with a senior data scientist in industry, kind of collaborate with them. But what we've learned is really personal projects are not best viewed as technical exercises. They're best viewed as stories. And getting good at pitching your story of what you learned, not just like the outputs, but even your struggle along the way, but also the outputs and framing them in exactly the way you describe it. I feel like that's such an under-leveraged skill right now in industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Like when we're interviewing, you know, I help interview engineers, and I would so much rather if someone came and said, "Hey, I built this project. It worked straight out of the gate. It drove X in revenue," and they kind of stopped there. They'd be like, "Okay, well, you know, driving X in revenue is good." But compare that to somebody that's like, "Here's what we thought initially. We had these three assumptions going in. It turned out this one was wrong. We validated that by this way. Here are three boneheaded mistakes I made that I won't make again. And the result of it is we drove, you know, half of X revenue." I would hire that half of X revenue person in a heartbeat. They're vulnerable. Like you just said, it's so powerful to say, here are the mistakes I made. Here's the things that I wouldn't do again. Here's why I thought about it. You know, show some introspection and some retrospection about where those things were coming from. But being able to explain the cause and effects and to bring people along it's a way more powerful way to sort of go about your life. And I used to think that was sort of a sales trick, you know, this kind of idea of storytelling. That's like, you got the slick sales guys and or salespeople, and they'll come in and they'll kind of wine and dine you with some stories. And it's how people learn.
Yeah.
And so we need to like stop pretending it isn't and just say, great, storytelling is how people learn. Everybody needs to be telling stories. For data folks like ourselves, we're telling data stories. For marketing folks, they're telling marketing stories. For salespeople, they're telling sales stories. For executives, they're telling executive stories. It doesn't matter. It's being able to bring people along, and stories do that.
So what fraction, just because, you know, obviously narrative science is focused on this mission of bringing storytelling literacy to the world, if I can put it that way. What fraction would you say of people who apply to work in, say, in your company actually have that ability, that competency coming in the door?
I would say not many. It's my personal belief, and I'm absolutely included in this, that is if you haven't consciously improved at storytelling or communication, then you're not good at it. There are probably some people that are just natively good at it, and we can just sort of gawk and admire and be a little jealous of them. For the rest of us, and again, myself certainly included, it's a thing you need to get good at. And it's weird because it's a thing that, I have a 4-year-old and a 18-month-old at home. And so I have these kind of funny experiences where I see kids like, kids learning language, and what kind of languages mistakes do they make? And then I see our software making mistakes. And it's like, oh, is that the same kind of mistake? Is that different? But it's, you see kids and they're so good at storytelling, right? And the stories, they don't make any like logical sense, but there's a ton of enthusiasm. They bring you along, they bring the other kids along. And then at some point we kind of lose that. I think we associate it with kids and childishness. And it starts to be, no, we gotta be more serious. No, you don't do stories anymore. Now you do reports, you know, and it's, or PowerPoint decks, and it's gotta be really rigorously laid out. And that's you need to be able to do that kind of logical, rigorous thinking to, I think, in a lot of ways to get at the right answer. But then once you have sort of the numerical answer, then the work begins of how do you actually bring people along with that? And so that's, so I think for most people coming in, they don't have that. We have a tremendously friendly group. Like it's really, I like everyone I work with. This is sort of my only job. My only real job I've had. And I'm spoiled by not sort of seeing all the weird office politics and sort of infighting, the stuff that can happen at other places. So we've got a bunch of good natured people. But one of the things, like I mentioned, the storytelling workshop, and that's it's an 8-week program. We bring through like 8 or 9 people at a time. We meet every week for an hour and a half, and it's literally just, okay, Jeremy, you're going first. Stand up in front and you're going to talk for about 4 minutes. And then we're going to give you a bunch of really specific feedback of, hey, some of it's kind of tactical stuff. You said, too much. You said a lot of ums, your hands were fidgety.
Yeah.
Some of it's more structural things of, you know, you should start with a hook. You should end with a call to action. You should be explicit about what you're asking people to do. You should paint the difference between the world we live in today and the world we could live in if we follow your plan or do your idea. And so, and you see immediately people get way better. And it's like, I took training to do this at, it was called the Actors Institute in New York. And it was this 2-day intensive, and it was only 2 days, but it was like, this like literally changed my life. It gave me a bunch of skills, which is great, obviously, but it also gave me just a real appreciation for how important it is and how teachable it is. And I think the shame is that we don't teach it a lot of times. I think if you're really bad at public speaking, you might get feedback that says, hey, you really need to work to improve. If you're fine, I don't think you really get much feedback. I never did for the first, you know, 5-6 years I was here. It's like, oh, Nate gives talks sometimes. It always seems fine. And okay, great. And in my head, it was like, no, nobody tells me anything I should do differently. Therefore, I'm acing it. And it's just, no, you're not. You just know when it's sort of hard to give that kind of feedback, and people aren't comfortable with it. And so what I've noticed here is that people are very excited to learn and really sort of practice it. And it's super fun for me because we've been doing the workshop for about 1.5 years now. And now when I see people who have come through when they give talks and I recognize them flexing different things they learned, or they're more comfortable, more confident, they're like bringing people along. They get people laughing with the hook, and then everybody kind of settles in and is more open to the rest of the message. All that kind of stuff, actually seeing it applied is super satisfying.
It's really interesting that you actually see this evolution, this improvement over time. And I think it's something that, unlike quantitative skills, which can be measured much more easily, I feel like there's a deep tie-in, almost a meta tie-in here, because quantitative skills are easy to measure, so we tend to improve them better. When we have a KPI that we can stare in the face, we tend to iterate on that KPI in a very focused way, whereas communication, very nebulous. How do you even get feedback? It's much harder to get that information. What are some ways that people could improve their communication style, let's say, you know, as they're working on their MOOCs or working on their boot camps or their courses or whatever? Is there an activity that you found useful? Obviously, your training camp would be helpful, but I'm thinking for like a, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people here.
Yeah, I think the, I guess there's a couple things. One is to make sure you're giving it to a really diverse audience. It's easy to, you know, you're in a MOOC and you're giving it to other kids and there are other students in the class. They all have the same kind of context. And there's a phrase that we have here is you forget what you, I'm getting in trouble now for saying the phrase that I can't remember. the curse of knowledge. You forget how much you learn, right? And how much you know. And when you hang out with a bunch of people that are like you, it's another good reason to hang out with people who aren't like you. But if you hang out with everybody who has the same background, you all kind of know the same things. And so you develop shorthand for talking about things. You just, you know, assumptions that everybody has in the room, right? You mentioned the F1 score, and I know what that is, and readers probably do. And we can just say that and cool, we're all on board.
Yeah.
But there's a way that's limiting for a bigger audience, right? And so I think, you know, targeting your parents, targeting your friends who aren't into data scientists or aren't quantitative types, and making sure that you can actually communicate with them, and they may not, you know, they may not understand where all the variables came from or sort of why you chose this method, but you should be able to, like, why did you choose this method? You don't have to get technical with it. It's, well, I didn't have a beefy enough machine to run this other one. Okay. That's a good answer. Like, you should be able to say that and sort of understand why you did that. So I think part of it is making sure there's a big audience. And the other part is, making sure there's a big audience and actually soliciting feedback. Because people don't know sort of, when you're giving a talk, you say like, hey, let me know if any thoughts after the talk. And it can be hard to know, like, are you looking for, I should tell you, hey, you were sweating, just sort of like, you know, physiological, just like basic things, or like, you look like a wreck up there. Are you trying to not look like make sure you're not dying on stage, right? It's sort of one, and people will tell you that pretty well. It could be, you know, or speaking rate, that kind of stuff. And people can do some feedback around that, but just like, did it make sense? Did you understand why slide 13 was after slide 12?
Yeah.
Did you understand these terms that I was bringing up? Did you leave like with something concrete to go do, or was it kind of a vague, like, I guess I learned some things, you know, you want to lift people with like, next I'm going to go do this, and sort of having some of those checks and really encouraging, you know, feedback and frankness from people you trust. And that's, you should probably do that everywhere in life or everywhere you want to improve. You know, it's actually be soliciting feedback and taking it and acting on it. But I think particularly for communication and storytelling.
You mentioned the order of the slides too. And there's like, there's a communications component to that. There's almost also a conceptual component. Like, it's not super clear to me that it's even possible to separate communication from understanding. You know, if you don't know your stuff deeply, you're going to misorder your slides. You're going to introduce a concept that depends on another concept before you introduce the other concept or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to really understand it, and you have to really understand what your audience understands. And I think that's a way you can really show sort of credit and appreciation for your audience is actually taking the time to say, understand where they're coming from and what they know already, what their assumptions or expectations are coming into this. Like, I think we often underprepare for things where we think, you know, I put together a deck. It's going to be about 15 minutes to go through. There's going to be 10 people in the room.
Yeah.
Anybody can, you know, it's 5-6 slides. Anybody can kind of get up and do 15 minutes, like a reasonable 15 minutes on a reasonable deck, and it'll probably be kind of fine. But that's, you know, 15 minutes by 10 people in the room, that's 2.5 hours that you're taking out of the world, right? And you can get kind of high flu, and there's a certain amount of life on this planet that we have, and you're taking 2.5 hours of that. What is going to be worth that? Like, what you have to make sure that you're sort of, if you're karmically balancing this or whatever, but it's like, that's a lot. You should prepare for that. You should actually put in time to not just having the answer and then saying, great, it'll only be 15 minutes. I can kind of stagger through it. It's like, no, that's a thing you should prep for. You should understand where they're coming from. You should, you know, think about what their concerns are going to be and call those out and have slides for that or hit those, you know, before you get into it. I know you're going to be worried about this, but let me just, you know, here's where that concern is coming from. I think that's important.
It's interesting that you're framing it as you almost have like an ethical obligation to good communication.
Yeah, I think that's a real, like, I don't want to get too highfalutin about it, but I think that's a good model of sort of what you're taking out of the universe and what you're putting back into it.
Yeah, and certainly something that the audience in any case will appreciate. It's never a bad thing to overfit to their preferences.
Yeah, and you don't want to, you know, you have to balance that with honesty, obviously. It's not like, there's a bunch of executives, so I got to make sure to tell them something good, because they'll appreciate that then and then come for your head a few months later when that turns out not to be true. You know, you have to sort of solve for long-term satisfaction.
You got to do more than a one-step look ahead if you're an RL agent.
yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, one thing I do want to touch on just to wind things up here, because I want to get your thoughts on the future of data science as a whole as well. We've alluded to it with this, as you correctly corrected me, this trifurcation into different subfields here. But what do you see, like, from within narrative science and just more broadly as you look at the data science ecosystem, where do you see things evolving, and what would, maybe along the way, what would your advice be to folks who are trying to break in today?
The tightest advice I have would be to think about data science like kind of all careers as a set of tasks. There's thought about this with how AI is going to impact different industries and different jobs, right? A robot's coming from your job sort of in that space. And the response is, or one of the, I think, useful ways of framing that is every job is, or most jobs are composed of a bunch of tasks. And some of those tasks are going to be automated. There's going to be some AI or some product somewhere, some service that removes some of those tasks. But the job will sort of stay, and the actual task allocation will shift in that. So it's not going to be, you know, if you imagine for when ATM machines came out, it was like, we're going to get rid of all the bank tellers. And there's now more bank tellers than there's ever been, but they do different tasks. They don't just take your debit card and give you money. They do other things. And so when I think about what data scientists is going to be in the future, it's thinking about the different tasks that a data scientist does today, thinking about which of those are probably low-hanging fruit for different forms of automation. So, you know, hopefully the data cleaning and sort of the data munging and all of that kind of work is going to increasingly go away. And there's, you know, there's more and more products in that space. And so if you're, you know, thinking about a career in data scientist, you probably don't want to be the best data munger in the world. One, it's not super satisfying work. And two, like, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, AI is pretty rapidly getting better at. And so, but it's what I think about where you want to be focusing your energies. It's the place that AI is going to take a longer time to get to, or be harder for it to get to, or maybe never get to. And that's, again, not to keep harping on the sort of the personal communication side of it, but that's a lot of it there. And being able to, we're a ways out from an AI taking management through a model and sort of what that means for the, you know, economics of the company in 2020. Like, that's that's a ways down the road.
And presumably, once we get there, that's sort of the end of capitalism because we have an AI that can make business plans and it's kind of like
why is the human in the room at that point? You know, yeah. If you solved AI, you don't need AI to talk to a bunch of humans. But I hear you. So it's really the communication side. It's more on the relationship side. It's making sure that as much as you can, I think that you yourself are valuable to the company. It's not just your work, right? And I think for quantitative types in particular in data scientists, it can be easy to, you kind of want the work to stand for itself. And that, I think that's, is probably fine in a lot of places, but it's not the right mindset. I think you really want to be, you are a value to the company. You are intrinsically valuable to the company. That's the bar you should set for yourself. That's the mindset you should have. And along the way, of course, you're going to do work that's, you know, concretely valuable, but you're sort of, you're an engine that is providing value to the company. And whether that today that might be doing these models and also munging data, in the future that, you know, the data munging might be gone or the, you know, sort of data governance pieces might be different. You might be using, Amazon is now doing a lot of the deployment stuff you used to do, whatever that is. That's okay, because you are intrinsically valuable and you're looking for other places you can provide value. And that, like throughout my, I mentioned I was in academia and then shifted into narrative science, and I was an engineer here for 5 years and then shifted into product. And it was, I remember as I was getting near the end of engineering, it's like, I'm not doing a lot that's valuable here. Like we're dying for lack of product people, and we've got a lot of good engineers, and I am definitely not the best of them. And I shouldn't be doing this, man. This is kind of not what needs doing right now. And so I think sort of putting yourself on the hook for adding value and looking for the places you can do that. And whether, if that's in your job description, awesome. If it's outside your job description, that's great too. You know, hopefully I've been fortunate to be at a place that reward that sort of, speaking to the startup ethos earlier, it's at the beginning and even now, there's a lot of work that needs doing, and finding somebody that will do that work on the side or sort of as a passion project for them, that's great. And I think good companies similarly reward that kind of drive and initiative.
I think that's some very good advice, especially the, there's so much here to chew on, but the communication, the product stuff, the startup ethos. Thanks so much for doing this. I do want to take a second to ask if you have any links that you want to plug. Are you on Twitter? Or?
I am on Twitter. Technically, I'm ND Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. I'm Nate Nichols on LinkedIn. That's where I'm active. My Twitter is sort of, it's supposed to exist for professional reasons, but I don't actually do a lot on it.
All right. So guys, you can go follow Nate ideally then on LinkedIn. I happen to know that he has a couple of articles published there that are actually quite interesting on the topic of communication and storytelling in data science. So definitely check those out. Nate, thanks so much for joining us for this.
Great. Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me, Jeremy.